et sur location.
De quoi le sortir?
Location.
Welcome to Echolocation, the show that eavesdrops on Mother Nature. I'm your hostess, Elizabeth Lojudas, and we're listening to a chorus of birds who were singing at the crack of dawn at around 5 a.m. near my home in Greene County, New York, on the longest day of 2022. June 21st was summer solstice, kicking off the season with the longest period of daylight of the year. Over 15 hours of daylight here in the Northeast. So we're going to start out the show with the vibe of summertime. Here's a song called Summer Solstice.
Summertime.
That was a song called Summer Solstice by DJ T-Rock Squashy Nice. On Echolocation, I feature art and science inspired by natural sound. And on today's show, I'm going to focus on the science of bioacoustics, as well as scientific research that uses sound technology. And some of this work is happening close to home, right here in the Hudson Valley. So we're going to listen to an excerpt from a talk that was given by Aaron Rice, who is a research scientist who studies how animals produce and perceive sound. Dr. Rice provided this talk for the Hudson River Watershed Alliance last year. And if you care about the Hudson River as well as the waterways that flow into it, you should know about the Hudson River Watershed Alliance. It's a nonprofit organization with a mission to unite and empower communities to protect their local water resources. And they work across the Hudson River watershed to support watershed groups and help communities work together on water issues and communicate as a collective voice. And a watershed is an area of land from which water drains into a river, stream, or other water body. And the Hudson River watershed covers almost 13,400 square miles, and it includes hundreds of tributary streams. So the vision of the Hudson River Watershed Alliance is to connect people to the water in their communities and build a network of effective watershed stewards to ensure clean and abundant water today and into the future. They're a collaborative network of engaged, informed, and active community groups, organizations, municipalities, agencies, and individuals that work together to ensure a healthy and resilient Hudson River watershed. And their website lists over 40 local watershed groups that are part of the alliance. They lead educational, capacity building, and networking events to inform and inspire communities to protect and restore our water resources. And they seek to build effective water stewardship by giving people the tools, information, and resources they need to better manage their streams and tributaries. And if you'd like to learn more about the Hudson River Watershed Alliance, visit their website at hudsonwatershed.org or follow them on Facebook and LinkedIn. One of the programs the Alliance provides is an ongoing lecture series featuring topics related to the Hudson River. And Aaron Rice's talk, which is entitled Soundscape Indicators of Biodiversity, Ecosystem Function, and Human Influence in the Hudson Watershed, was given as part of their breakfast lecture series that ran last June. Aaron Rice is a biologist who leads marine projects at the K. Lisa Yang Center for Conservation Bioacoustics at the Cornell University Lab of Ornithology. His current research focuses on the production and perception of sound by fishes and whales, and he uses this information to address two key areas in coastal ecology, one being how sounds are produced and used to structure social behaviors, and how he can use the spatial and temporal occurrence of species-specific sounds to understand the population dynamics of vocalizing species. If you'd like to learn more about the K. Lisa Yang Center for Conservation Bioacoustics, you can go to www.birds.cornell.edu/ccb. And we're going to listen to an excerpt of Dr. Rice's talk that describes bioacoustics and his research on fish sounds in the Hudson River. And since there was a slide presentation as part of this talk, you'll hear him referring to images of spectrograms of the recordings of underwater sounds. And a spectrogram is a visual representation of the spectrum of frequencies of a signal as it varies with time. So you don't have to be looking at the spectrogram to get the gist of his talk, but if you'd like to watch the entire lecture with visuals, you can find it on YouTube, and I'll link to it from the Echolocation Facebook page, which is echolocation/WGXC.
I'm a marine and aquatic biologist by training and inclination. And one of the things that sort of defines my research program is trying to study animal behavior and animal ecology through the sounds that these critters produce. And one of the things that's been exciting, particularly at a place like the Lab of Ornithology, where the first sounds in nature were recordings done in Ithaca in the 1920s and 30s. And so Ithaca has always been this sort of nexus of this quirky little field that we hear about called bioacoustics. So much of bioacoustics as a field sort of emerged from other fields. So, you know, being able to use ocean sensors to pick up whales, well, a lot of that comes out of trying to pick up undersea earthquakes, or much of bioacoustics in its present formation directly comes from World War II with anti-submarine warfare. And so the first hydrophones were developed by the U.S. Navy. They became available to civilians shortly after World War II. And so this field is directly a result of listening to the aquatic environment in very different applications. So there's a lot of different aspects of bioacoustics that we'll sort of go over. But I think, you know, when people hear this word, it's intuitive for some, not for others. But I would surmise that you are more familiar with acoustics as a discipline than you may realize. Sound in the environment is one of these sort of cues that we use as humans over evolutionary history to really sort of sense and perceive the world around us. And so these could be from environmental cues or people talking or sort of other components. And this same pattern holds true across the animal kingdom. So this field of bioacoustics fundamentally is the study of animal acoustic communication. So we know that across the animal kingdom, sound is regularly used as in the context of intra and interspecific communication. And certainly for those of you that are birders, the idea of birdsong is a really obvious component of bioacoustics and has been the foundation of the field. Particularly at this time of the year, I'm sure that you all have been hearing about the emergence of cicada brood 10 and the obnoxious sounds that they may be producing. Obnoxious is subjective. I think it's great. But, you know, so you got birds, you've got insects making sounds above water. And then below water, certainly the sounds of humpback whales that started to be described in the 1970s are one of the sort of common components well appreciated components of the underwater soundscape. But then what I'm going to try to convince you of over the next 30, 40 minutes or so is that equally interesting and exciting are the sounds produced by fishes. So, you know, here you have three or four toadfish. Down at the south end of the Hudson River. And I think these guys are a very much underappreciated but really fascinating component of underwater soundscapes. And so in addition to studying animal sounds and what they're doing and when they're active, we can also start to study sort of the overall sort of more complete record of sound that include not only environmental components like rain and wind and things like that, but also the human footprint on ecosystems. So one of the challenges that human footprints on different ecosystems creates is it very much constrains sort of the acoustic ability for these animals to communicate. And in fact, what we will see is that animals across all taxonomic groups and all ecosystems really use sound as a fundamental component of their life history. So we've talked about a couple of different things. We've talked about the communication, we've talked about soundscapes, and a lot of this is sort of coalescing into this emergent, relatively recently described field of acoustic ecology, taking different components of the production and perception of sound, how those aspects of sound may influence behavior, what are the consequences of human-generated noise on ecosystem function, is there injury, is there stress, and how can animals sort of use these different pieces of information to understand the environment in which they live. A project that we've been doing of what can broadly be described as understanding the different soundscapes of the Hudson River as it extends basically from Albany down to Manhattan. There's a couple of different aspects of this project. You know, broadly, what is the acoustic diversity and ecology of the Hudson River? which species of fish are making sound. We know that there's lots of different fish in the Hudson. What is the influence of humans on these different ecosystems within the Hudson and its tributaries? You know, including things like dams and their removal, the footprint of different transportation systems going north and south along the river. And then finally, being able to understand how do environmental changes along the Hudson modify both the soundscape as well as overall aquatic biodiversity. So we're not the first to try to record in the Hudson. There was an effort by a team a few years ago, at the time out of UMass, starting to do some recordings and working at two different sites within the Hudson River Estuary National Estuary and Research Reserve. And one of the, in addition to being able to find well-characterized fish sounds, like things like toadfish and some catfish, you know, what they were finding was a whole host of mystery sounds. So we're getting all of these really species-specific, unique sounds. The problem is we have no idea who's producing them. So one of the patterns that emerges not only in the Hudson, but in aquatic systems around the world, is that everywhere we listen, we're hearing more sounds that we don't know what they are than we do that who's producing them. So how do you solve this problem? So one of the things that we do in ecology and evolutionary biology is this idea of inference, where can we take information that we, you know or predict in one particular context and start applying it to another. One of the things that's really exciting about working on fish is there's about 34,000 living species of fish. There are more species of fish than there are all other vertebrates combined. So what I've been doing for the better part of 20 years is that going through as many records as I can find within these 34,000 fish species. And so going through the scientific literature, looking for every case I can find of fishes producing sounds. And it turns out it's a pretty rich literature with a really long history. Some of the first descriptions of fish sounds go back to Aristotle. You've got folks like Darwin that were interested in it. And then the field with the advent of digital recording technology has exploded in recent years. It is a really, really active area of study. Many, if not most, species of fish are producing sound in some context. And where you have gaps, like a lot of the deep sea fishes, a lot of these are fish that have never been analyzed before. People have never tried recording them. And so in many cases, what we are overwhelmed with is an absence of evidence rather than an evidence of absence. And so this is sort of what I think about on a day-to-day basis. Let's jump back to the Hudson. So when I go to different places, one of the first things that I really like to see is a fish checklist. I get really excited about seeing a place with great fish diversity. And so this is the Hudson River Estuary Program fish checklist that you can download from the DEC website. I'm sure many, if not most of you, are familiar with it to some degree. What we see are 226 different species found along the stretch of the Hudson. I believe there was a goby that was just reported from the Hudson, so now it's 227. And so this is the way that most folks view it from a biodiversity perspective. But the way that I start to view fish checklists and things like this, saying, okay, well, how many of these fish produce sound? So if we overlay the number of fish that have been recorded before with a green box, that starts to look like something like this, where it's not just one or two, we have dozens of fish that have been recorded from the Hudson River, which gives us a lot that we can do with this idea of recording sounds. Then you could say, well, some of these fish may not have been recorded before, but they're closely related to these that have been recorded and produce sounds. So what does that look like? So if we take species from members of families that produce sounds and put a little blue box around their name, we get something like this. So what you can see is the vast majority of fishes found in the Hudson River that we know of are likely producing sound in some context. So what immediately emerges is we have a lot to work with, that the idea of using a hydrophone to understand soundscapes and fish diversity actually may, there may be something to that. So how do we go from a list like this saying, well, yeah, these guys at Cornell, they think they know what fish sounds like, but you just showed us a picture of all of these unknown sounds. How do you reconcile what might be producing sounds with the sounds that you get? And so we can use several different methods to try to do this. So we can go, there's a number of online data repositories where you can listen to different sounds. So one example is our sister department within the Lab of Ornithology, the Macaulay Library of Animal Sounds, that has a whole host of fish sounds as as sounds from other critters. There's also, you know, other repositories known, the discovery of sound in the sea, where from an educational perspective, people can download and listen to example fish sounds. We can go to the scientific literature and look for records of spectrograms or waveforms, or from the older literature, anecdotal accounts or qualitative descriptions of different events. And then we can do things like targeted fish recording, saying, okay, you know, enough homework, enough looking at you know, computers and books, let's go ahead and get out into the field. And so last year, despite the pandemic, we actually ended up being pretty successful, being able to deploy instruments on different stretches of the Hudson. And this is really due to the not only the location, but just the fortuitous collaboration with both Patrick and Maya, that having collaborators on site when we in Ithaca are locked down, we can't travel. It's really wonderful having collaborators who can easily get instrumentation in and start to collect data. And so we worked, last year we recorded about 5 different sites, each for about 5 or 6 months, you know, down as, you know, as far south as Furnace Brook, above and below the Maiden Lane Dam, and then up around the Norrie Point Environmental Center, Enderkill Creek and Black Creek, and you can see blowouts of those here. And each of these were sort of designed to sort of start to target different questions. And then we've got a number of other recorders that we're moving up and down the Hudson to record other events as they either are interesting or we have questions or there's sort of management or regulatory contexts that emerge. And so comparing both above and below the water of the Hudson. So this is at Norrie Point, and this is about a week of sound. And so on the left two panels, you can see hydrophones. On the right, you can see microphones at the same site. And so below water, you can see this the acoustic footprint of a storm coming through. Here's some different fish activity. Above the water, you're seeing spring peepers in the evenings. Here's that same storm event. And then during the day, you're getting a combination of birds and insects calling. So even at the same site, above and below water, we have completely different animal constituents calling that are detectable, but these abiotic or environmental events like storms are readily detectable. And then if we look at a sort of a shifted frequency scale, so here on the top two panels, we have a linear frequency scale going from 0 to 4,000 hertz. Down below, this is what we refer to as a 1/3 octave band representation, where we can get better clarity on some of the low frequency components. And here, those fish sounds are more readily identifiable. The top part of the storm is scrunched down, but you can see that low frequency component. And then for the microphone here, you can clearly see the birds and insects, the storm, and then the frogs are just these little pixels up at the top of the screen. So this gives you an idea of what Norrie Point might look or sound like for a week during spring of 2020. And then jumping down to Furnace Brook, you know, we're getting all sorts of sounds. So here's some focal recordings of patterned sounds, certainly from fish, not really sure which ones yet, but you can start to see a bunch of different types of sounds that are emerging with different patterns of sort of pulses or snaps or pops that emerge. And within the idea of looking at barrier removal within the Hudson, there's certainly a lot of stakeholder interest on both sides of it from this. And one of the things that in using acoustics that we can do is start to look at, okay, well, what does barrier removal do to be able to these communities? So we're able to go in to the Maiden Lane Dam, record above and below the dam before it was removed, get an idea of the soundscape, and then we can go back this year and then figure out how do things sound. And so in addition to things like barriers, you know, clearly the Hudson is a pretty active stretch with humans moving up and down the sides of it. So here's an example of what ships look like on the Hudson. So this is recorded a little over a month ago. This happened to be some survey work with some for the sturgeon tagging that was going on that we'll talk a little bit more about later. But you can see that with these, you know, clearly visible ship crossings, you can see it, the ship as it gets closer to the hydrophone. This is the closest point of intersection, and then it starts getting farther away. And it's really dominating much of the bandwidth. So this is going from about 0 to 12,000 hertz. And it's you can imagine that with this noise footprint of ships, it could really be difficult for other other critters to be able to hear each other amidst this backdrop. This is something that we refer to as masking, and is one of the potential consequences of human-induced noise in aquatic systems. It's not just aquatic transit that's an issue. Here's a slide that and some data that Patrick Baker had collected, something that he affectionately refers to as four frogs in a train, where in this spectrogram that's about 35 seconds in duration, you can clearly see four different species of frogs, you know, these spring peepers just going constantly. But then here's the signature from trains that's pretty much dominating this low frequency register. And one of the questions that emerges when we look at noise is what are the consequences? Do animals care? Is it just masking? Can they just not hear each other? Or are there other elements of stress or disrupted behavior that emerge from something like this? One of the things that's really interesting that's emerged in the last couple of years is that not only does noise influence communication, but we find that fish in noisy situations are more vulnerable to predators, their feeding rates change, and so we have not only acoustic impacts to fish, but a bunch of other non-acoustic impacts from anthropogenic noise. And so this is one of the reasons why ocean noise pollution or aquatic noise pollution is really finally gaining the attention that it deserves sort of within the scientific and regulatory community. So last year was, as you can imagine, a tough year to try to start a new project. We're just underway, sort of in our second field season this year. There's a number of sort of things that where we're going in some of our future direction. We've got a lab facility here in Ithaca where we've been able to collect fish that are found locally, but also are the same species they found on Hudson. So we've got an aquarium room full of fish with hydrophones constantly going to try to get lab-based or lab-recorded sounds that we can then look back at and from field recordings and start to match the species with those calling animals from field settings. What we want to start to do is figure out what is this sort of seasonal pattern and rhythm of the Hudson River. When do species start calling? How long are they going for? When do they stop? How are the different species groups that call together? How are they dividing up frequency space? Or how are they minimizing their overlap? How can we get into some of these, you know, sort of human-driven context of things like barrier removal? You know, what does the removal of dams create for Hudson soundscapes? You know, and being able to compare places like Furnaceburg to other sites in the Hudson that are similar tributaries that may or may not be sort of having barrier removal evaluated as an intervention there. Where we're currently at, a number of really exciting things going on. So one of the things that being fish ecologists and listening to fish, you know, we can also talk to other fish fisheries biologists. So, you know, Maya is so perfectly positioned and is able to work really nicely with the DEC fisheries team, you know, and so I'm stuck in Ithaca. Maya has the good fortune of getting hopping on the phone, saying, okay, let's get ready to go out on a boat. And this is a picture she sent me yesterday where she's targeting the Atlantic sturgeon aggregation that's happening. And so, you know, with these complementary species surveys, DEC is tagging fish. They're doing underwater video tows. They're doing different sorts of censuses for them. And this is a case where we can piggyback a lot of our acoustics on these known observations of sturgeon. So not only can we go after Atlantic sturgeon, we can go after short-nosed sturgeon with a similar effort. And, you know, and so here's a bunch of sturgeon that are about ready to be tagged that are in a pen. We can drop a hydrophone into there, hear what they're sounding like, but then also put a bottom-mounted recorder around the aggregation site to see what sounds these aggregations may be making, and could we in fact figure out when spawning is starting of sturgeon. So even though sound production is well known in sturgeons, it's kind of surprising that these two species critical to the Hudson have never been recorded before. So I'm hoping that, you know, in the future I can come back to you sort of being able to play back sturgeon sounds. These you know, the recorders for the Atlantic sturgeon just went in the water, the short-nosed sturgeon recorders just came out. And so these are sort of data that will be coming in the very near future. We can also look at the migration of herring up and down the river. So we put hydrophones near some of the weirs on Black Creek and being able to get the herring moving through those different systems. So this has been a really exciting project. It's really a fun thing to be a part of. I want to be able to thank our funding from the New York State Water Resources Institute here at Cornell. We've had a number of students and staff and collaborators involved in the project. And then, you know, if you want to learn more about bioacoustics, you know, follow us on the web or on Twitter. And if you have any questions, happy to take those now. Or if you want to email me in the future, always happy to talk more about it. So thank you.
You're listening to Echolocation on WGXC, hands-on creative community radio on 90.7 FM in the Upper Hudson Valley and everywhere at wavefarm.org. I'm your hostess, Elizabeth Lojudis, and we just listened to excerpts from a talk given by Aaron Rice, a marine and aquatic biologist from the K. Lisa Yang Center for Conservation Bioacoustics. The talk was entitled Soundscape Indicators of Biodiversity, Ecosystem Function, and Human Influence in the Hudson Watershed, and it was provided as part of the Hudson River Watershed Alliance lecture series in June of 2021. Since the talk we just heard focused on the use of hydrophones to study the underwater world, we're listening to the sounds recorded from the Wave Farm Pond Station, a solar-powered hydrophone array created by artist Zach Poff that continually broadcasts the aquatic soundscape from dawn to sundown each day. The sound transmitted is broadcast to local listeners on Wave Farm Radio, 1620 AM, and on WGXC, and it's streamed online to international audiences. In addition, Pond Station serves as a live, generative, natural instrument for Wave Farm visiting artists who may remix and interpret these otherwise inaccessible environmental sounds in their own work. So we're going to have a little musical interlude, and since Dr. Rice is coming to us from Cornell University, which is in Ithaca, New York, we're going to listen to an improv piece from Ithaca-based duo Kevin Chelly and Tom Law. And since we're thinking about fish sounds, we're going to listen to a piece that's called Sturgeon from their album Sturgeon. You're listening to Echolocation on WGXC, hands-on creative community radio on 90.7 FM and wavefarm.org. I'm your hostess, Elizabeth Lo Judas, and we've been listening to a piece entitled Sturgeon by improv duo Kevin Shelley and Tom Law. Sturgeons are some of the most amazing and mysterious fish that swim in the Hudson River. And our exploration of sound technology and scientific research is going to start to focus on sturgeon. So for a bit of background about these fish, I'm going to play a story that was told by naturalist Tom Lake about his encounter with an Atlantic sturgeon in the Hudson River that I produced a few years back. Today's story is about a shad fisherman's surprise encounter with an ancient life form.
They've been around for about 200 million years. My name is Tom Lake. I've been on the Hudson River for about 47 years. I've been involved in the Hudson, mostly with fish. My son and I were commercial fishermen for about 12 or 13 years or so. If my son could not come with me, I would take my wife. So it was one day I went out. Now, my wife was very hesitant about this because it was a rainy day, and she just didn't want to be out in the rain. We went out in our 15-foot boat, and we were drifting in the river, and the storm came. The rain was blowing sideways. There was so much wind, and we had 3-foot chop on the water, which is, we're talking about waves now. All of a sudden, my net disappears. It's drifting down the river with the floats on top, and everything's fine. I'm probably catching shad. All of a sudden, the whole net goes away. So we motored up, and we went over to the end of the net, grabbed the only buoy that was up, and we began to haul. And as we hauled that net in, little by little, coming off the bottom of the river, was about the biggest sturgeon I think I'd ever caught or ever seen.
Some call them dinosaur fish, and they look the part, with leathery skin that covers bony plates. Atlantic sturgeon resemble alligators or sharks, but they don't bite. They have no teeth, so they suck tiny prey from the muck for their sustenance. And on this simple diet, they grow to be giants.
They're enormous. They're the largest fish that regularly comes into Hudson. The possibility of some behemoth in the water coming after your net was always something that was very interesting. This one came up, and it was more than half the length of our boat. We have a 15-foot boat, so this was about an 8-footer. And this was a big female. And here she is, all wrapped with net on the surface, and half the net's in the boat, half the net's in the water. My wife is as far in the bow as she could possibly get without having left the boat at that point, soaking wet, not exactly having a good time. And I unraveled that sturgeon mesh by mesh by mesh, and as I'm looking at her, I'm thinking, at any moment, if she so chose, she could just slap her tail and she could explode out of that net, and it would have capsized us, pulled us in the river, and with the weather conditions at that time, we probably would have drowned.
An Atlantic sturgeon and a human have a similar life expectancy. Female Atlantic sturgeons can't even start laying eggs until they're teenagers.
They were born in the Hudson River, but they spent their lives out in the open ocean until they became mature, and then they come back.
When they return to the river on springtime spawning runs, these massive fish sometimes leap from the water as if defying gravity before plunging back down into the depths. Despite the aerial acrobatics, sturgeon are more down to earth when choosing spawning habitats. They lay their eggs in those rare spots where the muddy Hudson has a rocky bed.
There are places in the river where we had to offer even more protection to this fish that's on the endangered species list.
Efforts to prevent these ancient leviathans from becoming mere legend are yielding results. Populations of young sturgeon have reached a 20-year high on the Hudson.
Fish that are survivors.
Support for conservation initiatives will help this gigantic dinosaur fish to survive, so it can continue to lurk in the murk, leap for the sky, and sometimes catch us by surprise.
She was very peaceful, very quiet, and she let me take every single mesh off of her. The last one was around her snout, and when I took that one over, I had hold of her tail, And I just gave her a little shake, and she just dove down into the depths of the Hudson River. Sturgeon were one of the species in the river that always created these memorable moments. It's moments like this on the river that stick with you forever.
There are two species of sturgeon in the Hudson River. The Atlantic sturgeon that was just described is a migratory fish that uses the river for spawning, and the smaller short-nosed sturgeon, which lives in the Hudson year-round. Both of these fish are endangered species, and the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation works to monitor and conserve their populations. Atlantic sturgeon were commercially fished in the Hudson up until 1998, when a moratorium was placed on possession of these fish until the year 2038. Researchers are learning that some species of sturgeon produce sound. University of Wisconsin Sea Grant has a few brief recordings of sturgeon sounds recorded during field work by Chris Bowcast on the Wolf River in 2011 and 2012. And the website describes that these sturgeon will use their whole bodies to vibrate their swim bladders and create low frequency drumming sounds. So let's take a listen. While I don't know if Dr. Rice or other researchers have successfully recorded sounds made by sturgeons in the Hudson, there are other ways that sound is being used to research these fish. There are several ways that staff from the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation Fisheries Unit studies sturgeon. One is a catch and release program in which fish are caught, weighed, measured, and tagged with an identification device. This labor-intensive effort has been enhanced in recent years through the use of acoustic technology. One type of technology is called acoustic telemetry, and it uses sound to relay information to receivers in underwater tracking stations. So the tags that are placed on fish captured through the catch and release program are acoustic transmitters, and each tag emits unique sound pulses that are heard and understood by the underwater tracking stations. Some tags also contain sensors that relay environmental conditions such as water temperature and depth. Researchers can track the movement and habits of tagged fish to learn more about individuals and populations. Another sound-based technology that's being used to study sturgeon is called side-scan sonar. Sonar, which is short for sound navigation and ranging, is an echolocation-inspired tool that uses sound waves to explore the riverbed or ocean floor. With a sonar survey, a platform is equipped with a group of physical sensors that are called a transducer array. And this array emits an acoustic signal or pulse of sound into the water. If an object is in the path of the sound pulse, it bounces off the object and returns an echo to the array. The array can then measure the strength of the signal, and by determining the time between the emission of the sound pulse and its reception, the range and orientation of the object can be determined. And using side-scan sonar, researchers can actually locate individual sturgeon in the underwater environment. And an article by Andrew Revkin that appeared in National Geographic in 2019 describes how researchers from the University of Delaware used side-scan sonar to identify a huge Atlantic sturgeon that was 14 feet in length in the Hudson River. And quoting from the article, "Unlike a simple depth sounder, the side-scan sonar they were using that day sweeps high-frequency beams of sound out at angles, producing a detailed three-dimensional portrait of the riverbed and any decent-sized fish. and it's often precise enough to reveal the sturgeon's distinctive profile. So researchers are using acoustic telemetry in tandem with side-scan sonar to locate and count fish, and the data is used to mathematically estimate population numbers. And what they're finding is that although Atlantic sturgeon populations remain severely depleted on the East Coast, the Hudson River may hold one of the largest populations of Atlantic sturgeon, indicating that conservation efforts are having a positive impact. Before we close out this broadcast, I want to share another story that was recently in the news and involves both fish and mammals that use echolocation. On June 11th of this year, an article in the New York Times by William J. Broad entitled "Eavesdropping on the Secret Life of Dolphins in New York Harbor" reports that researchers from the Wildlife Conservation Society deployed hydrophones to listen to the echolocation clicks of bottlenose dolphins. The population of bottlenose dolphins has been resurgent in New York Harbor in recent years, perhaps due to the recovery of a type of fish called Atlantic menhaden that is a favorite food for them. From 2018 to 2020, the researchers set up hydrophones in six locations off Brooklyn, Queens, Staten Island, and New Jersey to document when and where dolphins fed. By studying the dolphins using acoustic tools, researchers hope to identify locations where the dolphins congregate and feed to provide information that will help to prevent human-wildlife conflict, such as accidental collisions between bottlenose dolphins and boats. We're listening to Summer Solstice by Trio Kate, and before it we heard Summer Solstice by Vincent and Van Orn. Thanks for listening to this edition of Echolocation. Special thanks to Emily Vail from Hudson River Watershed Alliance and Aaron Rice from the K. Lisa Yang Center for Conservation Bioacoustics for sharing audio of Aaron's talk, and to Tom Lake for sharing his sturgeon story. As always, links, references, and a playlist can be found at echolocation/WGXC on Facebook. We're going to close out this broadcast with the sounds of evening song at around 9 p.m. here in the Hudson Valley. Wishing you a happy summer, and I'll see you in the fall. I'm Elizabeth Lo Judas, signing off.